seen anything like that.
I'm a very confident front runner for Caddy for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Fuck! God damn it!
I don't think he's pleased.
Of course, well, that's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course, we want to play at the weekend.
Yes, it is major championship week. The US Open is here, less than 24 hours away, at one of the toughest golf courses in the world, Shinnecock Hills on Long Island in New York. This is our Golf Weekly US Open preview. And to take us through it, we've hired two of the big guns. Gary Murphy is welcome as always. And we've lost one man who pretends he's working while traveling the world talking about golf. So we've decided to replace Sean Davenport with another one. But this man happens to be the venerable Paul McGinley, happens to be a European Ryder Cup winning captain. And Paul, these are your busiest of weeks. We totally understand it with all the work you're doing on Live From and with Sky Sports as well. So thanks so much for taking the time to speak to us. You are over on Long Island. You've been on the ground. How has your week been so far?
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, good, thanks. Yeah, all fine. You know, the course is what everybody says it is. I was here in 2018 as well. It was a tougher course then than we're going to see this week. Although the forecast tomorrow for Thursday in particular is very windy. But I think the USGA have learned the lessons. I think they're going to err on the side of caution. The fairways, obviously, a lot of talk about those are a lot wider. Some of them are up to 60 yards wide. It's incredible how wide they are for US Open. But don't be lulled into a false sense of security, because the greens are what's really, really difficult. And if that wind blows, they're very, very tiny targets. They might be big in size, but tiny in terms of the area of the greens that you can put pins into.
Gary, Shinnecock Hills is what Carnoustie is to you, an open championship. When the conditions are in a certain way, the circumstances are right, it is the toughest test that you can possibly get in US Open golf, like pushing the players to their limits emotionally and physically. And even if, as Paul says, it's maybe not as at risk of getting away from the USGA as it was in 04 and to a lesser extent in 18, this is still going to be a gnarly old test for these boys, isn't it?
It is, and it's going to be aligned with, you know, course setup. I remember, I think it was back in 04, I think Joachim Hegman played, and he was saying on maybe the Sunday morning, he was bouncing his golf ball on the putting green, and it was literally bouncing nearly up into his hand. Such were the conditions and how firm it had gotten, David. So it's all about how they set it up. Like, the course is an animal in its own right. So let's hope it doesn't get away from them, and we're going to see, you know, the artistry and unbelievable skill that these top players have, and we want that to come out. And I think it's going to be a fascinating 4 days, and I wish it was McGinley on the ground watching it all. But it's one of those venues where, you know, I think Koepka was phenomenal the last time around here. Goosen putted his eyes out to win. So, but it's going to take all facets off their game, as Paul said. You know, the big white fairways are there, but you possibly, with the wind, they're not going to be as play as wide as that, but certainly try to navigate the greens and approach play is going to be huge.
In terms of our short history lesson for some of our listeners, albeit if you're listening to this, you probably are a golf nut and a major championship nut. Only two players finished under par in the last two tournaments that were staged here. You've mentioned the two of them, Gary Goosen in 2004. That was the major in which Tiger Woods said that the USGA had totally lost control of the golf course. And then, unfortunately for Brooks Koepka, Phil Mickelson was probably one of these standout memories from 2018 when he swatted at a moving putt before it had even come to rest, because he understood the ball was going to leave the green and he was happy to take a two-shot penalty at the time. So with all the controversies that went with those events, that's what sort of springs to mind when you think of Shinnecock Hills. And Paul, we're always on YouTube and Instagram and the build-up on the Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday of a major, and we're looking at golfers dropping the ball into the fescue and then sticking their phone deep inside to see, try and give us an idea as to how deep it is. We're watching golfers purposely hit chips across greens and then seeing it go down the other end of those closely mown areas. You are on the ground, and as you said, the wind is going to be really high if forecasts are accurate tomorrow, so that course is going to start cooking pretty early. Are some of these little videos that we're seeing a real true portrayal of what's happening on the golf course as we speak, or are they a little bit sensationalized?
I think a little bit sensationalized, to be honest. You know, I've walked the course the last 2 days. There's certainly a lot of moisture in the greens at the moment. And listening to the USGA, what they've been saying, they don't want it to go sideways here. They are trying to get out of here unscathed. So there's definitely a lot more moisture in the greens. There's definitely a lot more width off the tees. I'm expecting the pin positions to be quite favorable in terms of not being near edges of greens. And one of the things with the soft greens that makes the golf course more playable is chipping. And one of the things to watch for on TV, you know, you hear a lot about missing, oh, he's missed it short side. So the pin's only five off the left and he's missed it in the bunker left and he's dead because he's missed it short side because the green is rock hard. That's not necessarily the case this week. And the reason is the wind. The short side is missing it where you're chipping into the wind. If you're chipping into the wind, you can create a lot of spin and stop the ball, even in a short space of time. So not having rock hard greens, like Gary just explained there with Joachim Hegman, is absolutely key to scoring. And I think the bit of moisture in the greens is as difficult as it's going to be. I mean, even tomorrow, if the winds are going to blow like this, you're going to see a lot of guys hitting good shots that are going to roll off greens. But that doesn't mean they're going to drop shots because the short game is a lot easier when greens are soft. And if you're chipping into the green, it's even if you're short-sighted, it's so much easier than if you've loads of green to work with and you're chipping downwind and downhill. It's so hard to judge that distance. So the big key, more than anything for me, is course management. And if you are going to miss it in tough conditions, missing it so that your chip or bunker shot is coming into the wind.
And Gary, is not something that we've kind of feel has been lost around US Open, certain US Opens of previous years, where the rough has grown really thick around the green and that everybody tends to have to hit the same shot when they've missed the green. They have to gouge it out and then try and 1 foot or 2 foot for a par, depending on what hole it is. And it takes the chipping brilliance from the best short game experts away. Totally negates their advantage. Whereas if it is set up as Paul has described there, well, then those guys who can chip and putt with the best of them, the likes of McIlroy and Scottie Scheffler, it allows them to exercise that advantage.
It does, and it brings a variety of a skill set, whereas the other way, it's just, you know, you're gouging it out of the rough, and it doesn't matter how good some of these guys are. There's always an element of guesswork when you're not getting the ball first. But when you can chip it from a tight lie and get the ball first, then, you know, the proper, you know, the Shane Lowrys and these guys, I think it will have an advantage. And you're seeing a ball fizzing in on the green with a bit of grab, which, you know, is something that the weekend warrior, you know, is not able to do. So there's something special about that too. Plus, as we saw with Keimer when he won around Pinehurst, you know, there's an old school art of using a putter from around the green too. And that option is there. It's probably more of a utility club nowadays, but there's a variety of shots. And as always, dependent on the lie, even though we can see from TV, you know, the lie might look perfect. Sometimes it can be in a little indentation and it's not quite so. So it brings that variety. And it also brings a huge fear factor. You know, sometimes the bad chippers can gouge it out, but when you're coming up a swale from a tight lie, there's, you know, nowhere to hide. So I think it'll bring probably a bit like Oakmont would have done, or not Oakmont, but as I said, Pinehurst did. So I'm not saying the leaderboard is going to be similar to that, but DeChambeau got, you know, into contention and ended up winning, but he played some remarkable shots around the greens. He's an underrated chipper himself. Maybe his wedge play is not that great, but around the greens, he's got a great skill set.
When it comes to the course setup, Paul, I've been doing some, and look, you are obviously a huge scholar of golf course setup and design and the history that surrounds some of these great courses. It's without wishing to get into the weeds of it, there are certain portions of the golf course that are almost triangular in their shape. So if you were to place, for example, 10, 11 and 12, 9, 10 and 11, which are thought to be the three hardest holes in combination on the golf course, on each of those three tee boxes, you're actually facing the wind coming from a different direction. It's not like some of the links courses are on the coast, west coast of Scotland or England, where you're going out and you're playing with the wind and you're coming back in and you're playing against the wind. Should we be looking in detail at great wind players when we're trying to pick a winner this weekend, or is that going to be overblown a little?
Wind is definitely a factor this week. I mean, we're right on the very tip of Long Island here. Next stop, Mayo or Donegal, we really are. So it's a little peninsula, so it's always blowing here. The average average wind speeds are between 12 and 18 miles an hour in the afternoons in June. So expect that again. That's what we had yesterday. Yesterday was an interesting day because it was really calm in the morning. Winds were blowing. I kept checking my phone. Winds were blowing about 6-7 miles an hour. I thought, oh, this is a perfect day to play golf. And then around lunchtime, it went down to virtually nothing. And it was just perfect. There was hardly a breeze. It was hard to determine which direction it was coming from. There was so little of it. And then all of a sudden, just it kicked up, and it kicked up to about 25 miles an hour. And it's like, wow, what a change in the golf course here. So you're going to see that. But in terms of the architectural design, yeah, I hadn't come across that before. It's really clever, really smart. Every three holes are designed in a triangle, and you're playing. You have to adjust to the different wind directions with each hole. It's really, really smart architecture. It's a very let's call it a square site, and then you've got all these triangles fitted inside this square site, and that's how they've done it. It's really clever, and it keeps everybody on their toes in terms of trying to determine where the wind is. And the wind does switch. Like I said yesterday, it came from four or five different directions in the one day yesterday.
Gary,
can I just ask Paul a quick question there? Do you think that the partnership factor then of a really decisive aware caddy is going to be a huge factor for the guys this weekend?
Oh, yeah, caddies have a huge role this week. First of all, I mean, but look, they have everything now in their favour in terms of getting the wind right. They've got the wind maps. They're actually allowed to have a compass on the golf course if they want to check. But the wind does switch. So you've got to be, you can be over the ball and the wind can switch. So yeah, they've got to be strong to be able to, you know, to stop the player from hitting the shot and say, wait a minute, stop. Just give it 5 seconds there to see if it's going to reset to where the wind should be coming from. That's important. But I think the biggest thing, Murph, would be the missing the green in the right spot. There's loads of space around the greens. There's no big heavy rough around the greens this week. There's no gouging out a rough like we had in Oakmont last week. This is a completely different, or last year, completely different test than we saw in previous US Opens. There's loads of space. It's all links land. And off those tight lies, you can create a lot of spin if you miss it in the right place and get yourself up and down. But they're tiny. There's about seven greens on the golf course. There's about seven greens in the golf course where the actual pinnable position is a quarter the size of the actual green. The other three quarters of the green is just rolling away all the time. And you can miss your spot by 1 yard in a crosswind from 150, 160 yards, which is very easy thing to do. And you're ending up 30 yards away, and then you got to try and get it up and down. So that's the complexity of it. But there's a lot of greens that are quite flat too, and a lot of holes that are. So that's why they've made the fairways as wide as they have, is to give the players a little bit of a chance and not be coming out of the heavy rough. Having said that, these fairways are, I think they're averaging about 44 yards wide. So, you know, you go to your local course and you take what you believe to be one of the wide fairways in a golf course and pace across it, and then, relate that to 44 yards wide. It's very, very wide. However, should you miss it and go into the fescue round here, it's absolute jungle. I mean, you can be doing really well just to get it back on the fairway. That's what they've done. So it's a very, very different test from US Opens that we've been growing up accustomed to, of heavy rough. As Trevino used to say, walking single line down the fairways, they were so narrow, and really, really tough tests in that regard. This is a tough test in a different way. It's more about the conditions. It's more about the golf course. And it's more about the complexity of six or seven greens that are so difficult to get the ball on, even with no wind.
And so, Paul, the potential for you to hit good shots and not be rewarded, in fact, the opposite of be rewarded, big punish, knowing that you've hit a good shot, knowing that you've hit the shot that you intended to hit, and it runs off or it takes a sharp bounce into that fescue. We saw Scotty, for example, it'll come up again in a few moments when we get into the potential winners, having a go at his caddy, having talked about getting the wind wrong and hit the shot that he wanted to hit, and he's dropping out of the hazard. And we remember Jack, particularly when he was talking about majors, but also around Augusta, he used to say that you could pretty much rule out 60% of the field, because for any number of reasons, they're amateurs, they're too old, they're not long enough, they don't have the bottle that it takes to move from a regular PGA Tour event to win on a major championship Sunday. And he'd look and he could probably whittle it down to 15 potential guys that he had to beat over the weekend. You've played in four of these US Opens. If we get those sorts of Shinnecock Hills, his traditional conditions, where the players' emotions are going to be tested to breaking point, can you rule out an awful lot of guys in this field in that regard, where you look at them and you just think, if it comes down to it, this guy isn't going to be interested?
yeah, Well, I'll tell you what it is. It's going to test your patience like no other golf course. It really does. And I can see, if you look at the winners around here, and it's always good to start with what kind of style of player has won around here. And you look at them and you think, okay, Ray Floyd, gnarly, tough, gritty competitor. Corey Pavin, something similar. Then you go into Goosen, very similar. You look into Koepka, you know, very similar. These gritty, gnarly, patient golfers that don't seem to throw the head are the ones who win around here. You can put a blanket around. All of them have very similar personality traits and styles of golf. Also, really, really good short games, which is going to be important around here. So that's what you're looking for. I remember, you know, I played in what did you say, four US Opens, and I always got intimidated. I have to say, standing on the tee box, I wasn't a particularly good player out of the rough. I had a rounded swing, and you know, my game was built on hitting fairways. But if I missed a fairway, I was not a good rough player because I didn't come in steep enough into the ball. My swing wasn't built that way. So I stood on those tee box thinking, I was so intimidated knowing that if I missed a fairway, it was probably going to be a drop shot. So it's mentality is so important in playing the US Open. It's a really, really tough test. I think they've had, five Opens around this Shinnecock golf course, and only three people have broken par at the end of the week. So it's a really, really tough test. I don't expect it to be as difficult as it has been in previous years, because the USGA, I think, have learned their lessons. But it's still certainly going to be single figures winning this. And then, you know, I'm thinking if it is going to get under par, it'll only be 2, 3, 4 under par will be the winning score.
Okay, well, let's get into some of the standout groupings. It's a 2-tee start tomorrow on 1 and 10. There are 4 Irishmen in the field. GMAC is back playing Major Championship Golf, his first appearance in 6 years. He went through qualifying and got there. Borick Harrington and he are off at 19 minutes past 12 tomorrow. So it's an early start for them. It's kind of perfect for us if you can get yourself off on your lunch break. They are obviously on two different tees. They're not playing together. Rory's out shortly after. It's the all-European trio of Ludvig Åberg, Tommy Fleetwood and Rory. That's at 8:01 Irish time tomorrow. And then shortly after them, Scheffler is out with the reigning US Open champion JJ Spaeth at 1:15. Matt Fitzpatrick, Bryson and Victor Hovland, they're in the evening wave, 6:25. Shane Lowry is playing with Alex Smalley and Joaquin Neiman in the opening two rounds. They're out at 7:13. And then a real glamour, 3 former US Open champions and Justin Rose, John Rahm and Jordan Spieth. They're all out at 7:09. So if we want to get into some of the individuals, Gary, we'll start with the man we usually start with in Rory. Last time he was here, Shinnecock Hills 2018, started with an opening round of 80. And although he was 10 shots better off the next day, it wasn't enough to recover and make the cut. But since then, Gary, I know he hasn't won the US Open since 2011 at Congressional. 6 top 10 finishes in the past 7 years. And that obviously included runner-up finishes in 2023 and 2024. The highlight being that he hasn't won it, but he has become sneaky good at US Open golf since they were last at this venue.
He has, and I think his emotional variability has transformed really since, you know, those days of, you know, I'm on 4 or 5 years, I still haven't won a major, blah, blah, blah. He's obviously gone through all of that. The Grand Slam has happened. He repeated Augusta this year. I don't think we're going to see those. I know last year, post his victory, he had a bit of a lull, but I think he's more back on the page. My only worry is he, you know, seasoned enough playing since his victory at Augusta, but I do feel he's found a formula to get in contention, as he did at the PGA after a very slow start. I think he'll, you know, his game, he's a much better wind player than people give him credit for. I think he'll manage that part of the game. His short game is undoubtedly elite, probably a strength of his game at the moment. I think if he can putt slightly above his average, I think he's very, very dangerous this week.
All the talk around Rory this year, obviously, Paul has been around his driver, which is usually his best weapon. And we're not going to play the clip, but obviously he got into real technical detail when asked about his driving at Muirfield Village. And he really broke it down for anybody who is educated enough to understand what he was talking about, which, of course, you and Gary obviously are. but it did sound like there was a two-way miss going on. And even when he did strike it as he would like, because he was worried about what else was going on in the background, he wasn't even able to take full advantage of that. So he's had a couple of weeks to go away and work on it again. You've already referenced the far wider fairways average-wise than we're normally accustomed to at US Open Golf. Where do you think he is as regards the big stick coming into this week?
I think he's going to be okay. I walked with him yesterday. He certainly drove it well yesterday, and it was hard to take a practice ground in. What I liked about yesterday is we saw a reintroduction of these really low bullet ball flights. Rory's average ball flight is about 130 feet is how high he hits the ball. He's one of the highest ball hitters in the game, one of the reasons why he hits it so far. And he just launches it up in the sky. But with the winds this week, it's bringing it down. You know, he's well able to hit it 25, 30 feet off the ground, absolute bullets. I still carry 280 out there and chase out on these firm fairways. So I saw him play a lot of those shots yesterday off the tee, and that, you know, it's a lot easier to find a fairway with those low bullets than it is with the high ones that are buffeted by the wind. So expect to see some of that. I think the wider corridors, as Murph just explained there, will certainly help him as well too. A little bit more leeway off the tee in terms of the widths. And yeah, look, I mean, at the moment you'd have to say he certainly evolved as a US Open player. He went through a spell the last time he was here, missing three US Open cuts in a row, and it seemed to be a line in the sand for him, because he's come back as a completely different US Open player since. He brought Brad Faxon on side around that time. He started re-engaging with Bob Latella again around that time. And he's kind of knuckled down and determined that, you know, these golf tests, these tough tests, were something that he wanted to get better at, because he wasn't particularly good at them, and resolved to do that. And actually now I think quite enjoys it. So I think he's going to be in part of the conversation this week. I think a good start is important. Getting away and getting up, you know, somewhere near the top of that leaderboard in the first round and not being miles off the pace like he was at the PGA Championship. But he's also got a good draw tomorrow, A, because he's playing early, one of the first matches out, and B, because he's playing with two guys he's really comfortable playing with. And that's important for Rory.
Yeah, are we thinking, Paul, that the winds, as we said, are expected to be at their highest tomorrow, but that the morning wave is due to get the better of it?
Yeah, that's what it's saying. I mean, it can change, as I say, around here, but generally it's like an Open Championship. You know, first out, very first out, one of the first matches out often on the links golf course is a good draw. And you know, for the first round of the tournament, you want to get up and going and not have to wait till the afternoon when the winds will be at the strongest. And also the course will have dried out at that stage. Remember, these warm winds are like a hairdryer through the golf course. And not alone do they bring more wind, but they certainly dry the golf course out, which makes it a lot more difficult in the afternoon. So he may well take advantage of those, you know, those conditions in the morning.
Gary, he was talking about the greens. He said he expects them to be difficult and that you need to have a lot of patience, not go at flags and being okay with hitting it 30 feet every time. When I read that, I was kind of a little frightened, because I felt that for 4 days at Aronimink, that's exactly what we watched, that the pins were tucked away and every player who found a fairway ended up having to hit the exact same second shot. And it was just a question of who was going to drain the most 25 and 30 footers. Am I totally misreading that?
No, I think the strategy, probably they were all similar, I guess, at the PGA. But I think the best player, you know, and the patience that's required this week, is the best player of our generation by far was Tiger. And he hit his target more often than not. It's just to find that target and having the composure and discipline to stick with it. And more often than not, that's probably not going to be the flag. As Paul alluded to, a lot of these greens, there's very little area for some for pin positions. So I think Rory is he's so good. At times you can lose sight of the fact that, you know, this is a marathon, and you can get a bit impatient and go, I'm just good enough to hit this shot. But finding that balance I don't need to do that this week. You know, I need to be where I need to be. He has matured massively at a US Open. He's already won one of them. He'll probably never win another one in that style, because he was young and precocious. He's a wily old veteran at this stage in golfing speak. But I dig his chances. I really do. It's, as Paul said, and he's so right, you know, a fast start tomorrow when the conditions might be sat down a little bit gets you into the tournament. And if he can pull something around par or under par tomorrow morning and be in around the top 10, you feel like your tournament is kick-started.
Yeah, he's actually fourth all time in subpar rounds at the US Open, which is quite something. And yet he's only won one of them. Before we move off him, Paul, anything else you'd like to add on Rory from what you've seen or heard around the place this week?
Not really. I mean, he's in good shape. I walked around him yesterday and, you know, he was bubbly, he was chatty. He was playing with Tommy, his practice round yesterday, who he's playing with in the tournament. Obviously, they get on well. And, you know, Rory's very comfortable in this superstardom that he is. And it's amazing, you know, in Ireland that sometimes, you know, we know he's a big star, but when you come over here and you see brand Rory McIlroy in action around here with the crowds, it's quite incredible. I mean, the screams and shouts for Rory are certainly 10 times more than they are for anybody else. His brand is that big and he's that popular over here. But, you know, he's controversial too. He's not afraid to put his positions out there. And he took a lot of headlines yesterday going out and talking about the new future of the PGA Tour and maybe we need to go back to where it was and we don't need to reinvent. And that created a lot of headlines around here, a lot of talking points yesterday. And, you know, he's not afraid to be controversial. He's not afraid to put it out there. And I think that's part of the brand of Rory McIlroy and the charm and why people are so interested in him.
Well, one guy we'd love McIlroy to be going at it hammer and tongs down the back nine on Sunday evening is we haven't really had Scotty and Rory being the two main contenders on a Sunday. So it's Scheffler's first crack at the Grand Slam. He's looking to become the seventh man to achieve that feat. Obviously opened the season with a win at the American Express, but he hasn't won since, despite generally putting together decent numbers. Paul, fascinated to get your thoughts on where you feel Scotty is mentally, because we love, and when I say we, I mean me. Gary's a man cut from the same cloth as you, you know, a dyed-in-the-wool golf pro, but I'm a journalist and I like to sensationalize things. I look for stories that maybe aren't even there, but I called him an a-hole on our last episode, Paul. You weren't part of it, because I just felt the way he was speaking to his caddy on that occasion that I referenced earlier and several dealings with the media over the last 3 months are examples of behavior that we've not seen from him before. And I wonder how closely linked is that to the fact that his game isn't where he wants it to be. He's clearly always striving for perfection. And this is the biggest event in some ways outside of winning his first major that he'll ever play. It is the first crack at the Grand Slam and everybody's talking about it. And it's going to be a really stiff test. Where is he mentally, do you think, coming into this week?
I must say, you know, the interaction with the caddy, let's start with that. I mean, Murph will tell you, there's not a player on tour who hasn't had that at some stage. And that was very, very mild compared to what the normal interaction is when player is losing the head and the caddy gets the brunt of it. I wouldn't play too much into that. And, you know, that was very, very mild. I think...
Paul, what's the worst thing you've ever said to your caddy? that you can actually speak about publicly?
I had a better call Edinburgh Jimmy, and I'll tell you what, whatever I said, I got it back 10-0. He wasn't afraid to give it back to me, so don't worry about that. I rarely got the better of it with the caddy, that's for sure. He caddied for Murph as well too for a little bit. You can vouch for me on that one, Murph. So let's start with that. I wouldn't read too much into that. What we see with a lot of these players on tour is, and the best players in particular, and a bit of amateur psychology here, they're normally very control freaks. They're very much control freaks and they're perfectionists. And that's how they play the game and that's how they see the game. And when the variables are not there, i.e. the wind and the firm conditions and the wind swirling, you know, they're at their best because they're in control of the ball from A to B. But when you put the variables in, that's when the difficulty comes and that's when they throw the head. And that's what you saw in Murfield Village. It was a very windy day that particular day and he thought he hit a really good shot and the wind caught it and blew it and it bounced then into the water. So when they get thrown out of their stride, that's when they're at their weakest. And that's what's going to test Scotty the most this week. He's a little bit itchy and, you know, he is losing the head a little bit, but you know, the other side of that is he's an unbelievable competitor, probably the best competitor in the game. And he's only won once this year, but I think he's had 8 top tens. It's just incredible how consistent he is week in, week out. Every part of his game is still a gold star. Everything is 9 out of 10. Last year it was 9.5 out of 10, and he's come off the boil just a little bit in every element of his game, whether it be driving, not quite the same, but not bad at all. I think he's ranked second in driving off the tee. Same with his iron play, same with his putting. So it's all there. The competitiveness is there. And yeah, he's a little bit frustrated that he hasn't won, because he won 5 times last year. The bar was so high, but he's certainly a factor this week. If you look at the predictive data that we have nowadays, and he's miles ahead of second place. If you just want to look at the data as to what who suits this kind of golf course, that's how good a player he is. That's how much he separated himself away from everybody else. But we know that golf is not played on paper, and you know, his attitude in these trying conditions this week is what's going to determine how successful he's going to be, because everything else is there. He'll certainly be in the conversation, let's just say it that, and I'm not surprised at all should he be winning, because he's due to win a game. The rest of his game has been so solid and so consistent for the year.
He's out on that morning wave as well, Gary. What are your thoughts on Scheffler this week, outside of him obviously being the favourite and most people's picks? What else are you seeing in terms of Scheffler?
I think the thing always with Scheffler is like, if you're a multimillionaire and you're going to buy, you know, a proper racehorse, you just look at the breeding. If you're trying to pick someone at a golf tournament, you have to look at the stats, and you can't deny them. And his stats suggest, you know, if he plays his game, not unbeatable, but it's impossible to see him out of, you know, contention very, very late on Sunday. But there is a little bit of frustration. If he can micromanage that, I think he's going to be unbelievably difficult to beat. Is he now going to do it this week and go on a run for the rest of the season and, you know, and rack those wins up? As Paul said, you know, he's won and he's had 8 top 10s. He had some guy every week that's just pipped him by a share or two. So his levels are so high. The only thing with it is, you know, nothing lasts forever either. And if maybe he's at Everest and he's starting to slide a little bit, I'm not suggesting that he is, but his numbers are down a little bit. If he can get back, I think emotionally more than anything, because physically it's all there, miles ahead of everyone physically. And then align that to a Grand Slam, and this is his national championship too as well. So it's trying to deal with that, as they all have to. This is one of the 4 weeks of the year where they have, you know, feel they need to be perfect to do it. So if he can micromanage those little details, I think he's going to be unbelievably difficult to beat.
Another Irishman in the field, Paul, is Shane Lowry. And we spent a lot of this year talking about him on Golf Weekly. Unfortunately, not all of it positive, given how close he came to winning on a couple of occasions in the Middle East and then at the Cognizant as well. He has US Open pedigree, but it seems an awful long time ago now when he finished second to Dustin Johnson at Oakmont all the way back in 2016. He missed the cut at last year's US Open. He missed the cut when they were last at Shinnecock Hills. And a couple of top 20 finishes is the best that he's managed in this event since that second place finish. All just doesn't seem well in Lowry's world at the moment, Paul, but we know the tools he has. We know the shot maker that he is and what he's capable of. Is there the capacity for him to maybe throw off the issues he's had in the first few months of the year and maybe produce something special this week?
It'll be unlikely that he would go from, you know, the flatness of how he was playing the last few months into winning a golf course this difficult. But having said that, if he was on his game and if he was on a good run and momentum was on his side in terms of good results, this is a test that could well suit him, because it's a big focus on iron play. He's brilliant at that. It's a big focus on playing in the wind. He's brilliant at that. Chipping, he's brilliant at that. And, you know, his putting, I know, has been quite solid as well too. So the skill sets are there. But, you know, he maybe not be the most patient player, and that's what's going to maybe test him around here this week. And then the second thing is, you know, I think there's still some baggage around in his head because of not winning those tournaments you mentioned earlier in the year. He hasn't really raised a gallop since those tournaments, and obviously it's affected him, because, you know, when you don't come over the line and you fold the way he did in those tournaments, it's you know, it takes time to come back from that. So golfers' careers ebbs and flows, and you know, Shane, from the high of last year and what he did in the Ryder Cup and you know, the last couple of years, how well he's playing, he's in a little bit of a flat period now, and knocked a bit of the stuffing out of him, and it's not just all of a sudden you just spring back and all of a sudden it's back again. down one week, you generally see a few tournaments in a row where he's kind of in contention and doing well and having good finishes. And that starts to build a confidence back up again to go on and play and win a tournament again. So momentum is not quite with him in his career at this moment in time, but you know, it'll come back because ebbs and flows of pro game. That's the way it is.
He had an okay week in Canada, Gary. He did play over par in his final round when he finished 9 shots off the ultimate victor, which was Bud Cauley. But so there's not really an awful lot of momentum that he's taking into the tournament from that event. But when Paul talks about patience, and it's clearly going to be a premium weapon this week, you have to be able to roll with the punches. And maybe that's not been Shane's best attribute over the years. Can you convince yourself to be patient in the build-up to an event like this? Or speak to your psychologist, speak to whoever you need to talk to try. Your caddy, for example, is obviously key to this, to try and stay in the moment, to try and move on from a bad shot, try and move on from a good shot that's not rewarded. Or is it something that is part of your characteristics? And if you just don't necessarily have that attribute, you're not going to find it in US Open week.
Yeah, I think he's just in a little bit of a flux at the moment in that, you know, the game's kind of going against him a little bit. He started off really well in Canada, and he just seems to be throwing in the odd bogey at the wrong time and can't get the other side of it. Momentum was against him a little bit. And that happens, you know, as Paul said, that always happens during a season or during a career. I think the key factor for him this week is Bob Rotella and also Neil Manship. You know, Neil Manship, whilst he's his golf coach, I think he's more of his kind of ear as well. And, you know, he famously references the big chats that he has with Neil. I think Neil has a big job this week in just trying to get him a little bit settled and accept whatever is going to happen. You know, he's just carrying it over a little bit. Like, he's not that far off in any part of his game. It's just a little bit of scar tissue from early in the season and just trying to reframe it. He's only 2 majors left this season. You know, so he's 2 wonderful opportunities, as he will do at Birkdale, and just try to get back into that mindset of being excited to go play rather than get the shoulders a bit low and, you know, get his chest out and relish the opportunity.
Couple of other people who are worth mentioning. Obviously, Bryson has won 2 of the last 5 US Opens. Actually, Paul, testing a new driver this week that it only actually landed on the USGA's conforming list on Monday of this week. So he may not necessarily put it in the bag for tomorrow, obviously. But he's missed the cut in both the majors this year. He hasn't quite seen himself outside of the live environment. And yet when he rocks up at a US Open, you talk about the superstardom that follows Rory around. I'm sure Bryson's not a million miles behind that either, given his profile and the amount of eyeballs that are always on him. What have you seen from him this week?
I mean, he's using a version of the TaylorMade that kind of just been a little bit more accustomed for the speeds that he has. I don't see him playing great this week. I don't see him being a factor. His form in the majors has been poor. I know he's done well in live, but it's been generally, go back to the point I'm making earlier about being perfectionists and control freaks. I mean, he very much fits that mold. And the tournaments that he's been playing in on live, you know, have been pretty much generic conditions. And I know he's played well in those conditions against, you know, pretty weak fields. But this is a completely different test. The 2 majors that he's played this year, he's been poor in both of them, missing the cut. This is not going to be any easier for him. This is a bouncy, firm golf course that's going to require precision. That's going to require brilliant chipping and brilliant putting. And we haven't really seen that from him in the majors this year. So I can't see him really being a factor. But when you talk about a quality player like him, you're never going to discount him. But I don't see him really racing a gallop around here. I just don't think the conditions suit him. I also think he's distracted with all the circus that's gone on with Liv, and he's very much part of trying to reinvent it as a different business. And I know he's in a lot of meetings, and that's a lot of distraction in the player's head. You know, if you look at Scottie Scheffler, go back to him again. You know, his life is very, very simple. And you wonder, how is he ever going to get derailed? Is life going to get in the way? Because life does get in the way. Guys make money and guys have families and all of those challenges come along. And that can kind of, you know, change you as a person and also take away your focus that you might have had earlier in your career when those situations were not there. And I think at the moment he's got a lot of distractions going on, particularly around Liv and the circus of whether it's going to reinvent itself as a new business model and he's going to be a shareholder in it and all the stuff that goes with it. And then trying to play a US Open on a golf course is difficult, having not played well in the majors this year. So he's not a guy that I would be pinpointing like I would with Rory or Scheffler, that will be a guy who'll you'll expect to play well this week. I do expect Rory to play well. I do expect Scheffler to play well, but not Bryson. But, you know, who knows? I could be wrong.
Gary, he's one of those players, it's equally fascinating to watch when he's in his flow and when it's unraveling for him. And he, one of the videos I watched of a player dropping the ball into the fescue and then having to go digging for it was of Bryson. And he kind of looks at the camera and he just says, I better not miss it here. And he obviously means that's one of any number of spots around the golf course that he can't miss it in. When it does get away from him, as it has done in multiple majors over the last couple of years, it's gripping TV. Because you just don't know what he's going to do, what he's going to say next, how smouldering and how dark his mood is going to become. So if he's in contention, brilliant, box office. If it's getting beyond him and he's starting to fray around the edges, it's equally amazing to watch.
It is, but I think his factor this week is his skill set. Like I covered his game at Royal St. George's, which was in 21 maybe. And he played with Jordan Spieth on the Friday afternoon, bouncy, tricky golf course, and it was windy. And Jordan Spieth schooled him on how to play golf in the wind and how to play links golf. This will be a similar challenge this week. He still hasn't defined the art of half shots and control and ball flight. And then he just doesn't seem to have that inherent ability to club himself. You know, he tries to do it through a computer. There's a lot of feel involved in hitting these shots. He still has to acquire that talent. There's no that he's box office, but I'd agree with Paul on this. I wouldn't say this is going to be his week.
Well, Xander Schauffele as well, unbelievable record. I was only hearing about this morning. Like, he started 9 US Opens. His worst finish is a tie for 14th 4 years ago. 7 top 10s in 9 starts. And a top 10 finish this week would actually see him move past Tiger Woods for top 10 finishes at the US Open. And yet, because he hasn't quite reached the form that saw him win 2 majors in a season a couple of years ago, no one really seems to talk about him. And I just think he is he's not quite a shark in the water, because he's a prolific winner and he's done it at this level, so you shouldn't be taking it for granted. But no one seems to be talking about him at the moment.
No. I mean, he doesn't have that personality that he's going to get headlines. And his game has been pretty decent without being spectacular. I mean, I've been disappointed in Xander since he won those 2 majors. I thought he's going to open the door there and be a serial contender like the way Scotty has been in these major tournaments, because his game is so fantastic. It really is. He swings the club great. He hits it a long way. He's got control of his ball. He's able to change his ball flight. He's a great chipper, a great putter. And I thought once he kind of got over that mental hurdle of winning a major championship and then doing it again, I thought, wow, well, let's look out. But last year was a very disappointing year for him. I know he carried a little bit of an injury at the start of the year. And this year he's come out, although he's come out and played half decently, again, he hasn't really been a factor. There's not much noise around him. So if he were to win, it would be a little bit of a surprise. He's not certainly one of the guys that you'd look at and think, yeah, he's absolutely primed to win. Normally you can tell with guys, it's unusual for a guy to go from kind of mediocrity and then into winning. Normally they're primed with a couple of decent performances coming into it. And this is going to be a difficult test this week, but he does have all the armory to sit this exam. He does have it. He is a guy who's won an Open Championship and in windy conditions and firm conditions. So, you know, you're not going to discount him. I wouldn't discount him as much as I would discount Bryson, but I wouldn't put him down as one of my 3 or 4 favorites.
Paul, is there anybody else that we should name check before we look towards wrapping things up? The defending champion in Shinnecock Hills terms is Brooks Koepka, but he's got some sort of an issue over the nerves in one of his hands that forced him out of last week's Canadian Open. And he's not 100% sure he's going to be at his absolute best. Adam Scott playing his 100th consecutive major, which is obviously an achievement in itself. Tommy Fleetwood, Matt Fitzpatrick, previous US Open champion. You'd feel he probably has the mental and physical tools to win around here. Anyone that we should mention that you feel could be a real force over the next 4 days?
Well, I mean, it's so difficult to pick in golf. But you know, obviously you've got Scotty and you've got Rory. I would put Tommy in there as well too, as one of my top favourites. I think, you know, again, Tommy was playing with Rory yesterday. His game was fabulous. I love the way he was controlling the ball in the winds yesterday. He's able to move the ball both ways. He hits it a good distance. He wasn't that far behind Rory off the tee yesterday. His game is primed. You talk about a guy priming coming in. I think he's primed. It's just getting over that mental hurdle of winning a major championship, you know, and that's where he sits at the moment. He's now won one of the biggest events on the PGA Tour, which is a big step for him. But, you know, winning, he has contended, but winning in majors is still something for him to be done. And of course, he shot 63 here in the last round before, so he obviously likes the golf course. He's certainly one to look. Then you go with guys just off the radar that mightn't be talked about a lot that are certainly could well perform and certainly be worth a good each way bet. And there's two that in particular that stand out, because I look back at the exam. I'm a great believer in courses for courses and sitting the exam that's in front of you. And this is a very, very unique and different exam that's going to test some different skill sets. And one of them is the mind and that ability to be patient. And again, you go back to the winners, like I opened up about the winners who have won around here, these gnarly, gritty, dogged competitors, emotionless, don't give much away and just keep grinding. And two guys come to mind. One is Matt Fitzpatrick. He's already won a few times this year on tour. He's had a great season. He's really bubbling and he's ready to win another major championship. He's got all the skill sets to win around this golf course. Great, great short game on top of a brilliant competitor. He really is one of the very best competitors in the game. And then the other guy is Patrick Reed. Patrick Reed played really well out in the Middle East at the start of the year. And he's a guy we all know has got one of the best short games in the game. The only question I'd have against Patrick Reed is his schedule has been incredible. I mean, since he's played those tournaments early in Europe, he's come back and he's played the Masters. Then he took a month off and played the PGA. Now he's taken a month off and played the US Open. Hasn't played a tournament in between. So we're interested to see, you know, how he's ready. But he did raise a gallop at the PGA Championship only last month. And, you know, he's a little bit off the pace in the end, but not by a million miles. So he'd be a guy that could well be suited to the exam that is this week. And they're the kind of guys that I look at. But it's so, so difficult with a big field of quality players like this. Who's going to get inspired? And sometimes all it takes, as Murph mentioned it earlier, sometimes it's a conversation that somebody like Shane Lowry will have with Bob Rotella, and you put him in a frame of mind and he just plays with that frame of mind for the week, and that's how he wins. And that's what happened to Darren Clarke when he won his Open Championship. I mean, he was all over the place the week before. He played terrible in Scotland the week before. He didn't want to play the practice rounds. He was hitting shots, taking his hand off the club with every shot he played. What am I doing here? I have no chance. But Rotella got in his head, put him in a mindset, and, you know, it happened to be his week. And sometimes that can happen in golf. It is unique, but it is sometimes it can happen.
And of course, fans of John Rahm will be wondering why we haven't mentioned him either. A two-time champion, former US Open champion, has had shown some really good form in LIV, and obviously went very close at the PGA Championship as well. Lads, I want to wrap things up with a story that is not really US Open related. It's to do with Mickelson, who's obviously not playing this week. And the US Open for so long, Gary, was his crack at the Grand Slam, and he had all those second place finishes, and then it seemed the win of the PGA Championship at Kew Island was the capstone on his career. He was beloved, hugely popular, one of the greatest, most revered major championship victories of all time. That's 5 years ago now. In his 50s, he managed to pull it off. And since then, his reputation has just been shredded. And this, a story that had been doing the rounds in recent weeks, but it was actually officially confirmed this week, is that he's lost his membership at his club outside San Diego that he was a member of for so long, the Farms Club in Santa Fe. They pulled his membership on the back of an incident that involved, as it was termed, unwanted contact with a female employee of the club. No criminal element to this. It's not going to go any further. But a tough year from Gary. He's missed the Masters and the US PGA Championship. He stepped away for personal reasons. Hasn't played since August. Obviously, he was the main driver behind LIV and the book from Shipnook and how all of this stuff we've gotten. We've talked that to death. But for a man who was so popular, and one of the guys I would always have sat down to watch, because he is one of the most charismatic, spectacular, swashbuckling players in the history of the game. When you see where he is today, Gary, it's really sad.
It is. It's a huge fall from grace, really. It's a demise in a career that, you know, he's obviously kept himself in great condition to get to 50 and still be able to win a major. And there's no doubt that his input in that whole LIV thing has put a lot of money in the pockets on the guys that play the PGA Tour. So whilst he's, you know, persona non grata, really, he did improve things, even though his departure to LIV was, I thought, a very sad way for him to end his career on the PGA Tour. Obviously, he's had major family issues at home that he's had to deal with. And now we hear this case with the golf. So it is a fall from grace for someone who was such a flamboyant entertainer. And everyone, you know, when he won a golf tournament, it was never in a mundane fashion. He was a phenomenal champion. And it's a pity that it's kind of petered out like this. And he can't see any way back, age profile, ability-wise. His time is done, and he should be graceful on the Champions Tour. And undoubtedly, he would have been winning, you know, a couple of times a year at a lovely autumn to his career, and it's a sad state of affairs.
Paul, I don't know how much detail you want to go into on this, but obviously you've been working that beat for quite some time now. You would have shared many's a room with Phil. What are your thoughts on where he is and the picture of his potential future that Gary's painted there?
Well, I think definitely his brand is maybe irreparably damaged. All that he's done, you know, he tried to blow up the PGA Tour in what he did with LIV, because it wasn't just going to LIV. He actually was actively recruiting PGA Tour players to go there. That's not forgotten over here. You know, he's admitted that, and that's what he was out to do. And, you know, when you take on corporate America the way he did, and PGA Tour is corporate America, it's often you're going to come out on the wrong side of it. Even the Saudis, for all the wealth, come out on the wrong side of corporate America. It's a ferocious animal. And that's what PGA Tour, as I say, is. So I think, you know, the point that Murph made there is one that I would have a similar view on. He has taken a stand on behalf of the players that has put unbelievable wealth into the hands of the players at the moment. He took a lot of reputational damage on behalf of the players for them to play for the money that they are now. Maybe some people call it, and Rory called it, a false economy yesterday, that the money in golf now is a false economy, that Saudi created a false economy. And I would agree with that. I mean, players playing for $20 million purses. You know, you had a situation a couple of years ago where Scottie Scheffler made more money than any starting quarterback in the NFL. You know, when you consider that their viewing figures are 50 times bigger than the PGA Tour, you know, it soon doesn't make sense for the money that's been thrown around in golf over the last few years. And, you know, there may well be some kind of a reset going on. And Phil instigated a lot of that. Then when it comes to the Ryder Cup, you know, the way he took down, you know, one of the greats in the game in Tom Watson was just, you know, totally out of order in Glen Eagles. But at the same time, on the other hand, you say, well, you know what? He did get more control in terms of Ryder Cups with the task force and everything for players. So they came out on the right side of that. And now Phil did it in the wrong way, but they did get more control from the PGA of America. And they've certainly got more control as well from the PGA Tour. Now the PGA Tour are giving the players media rights so they can use some of the footage of playing in tournaments on their own media channels. That wasn't the case before. So a lot of things that Phil stood for and took a stand for have really benefited the current players. They haven't had to get out of bed for all of these things to fall on their lap, while Phil is the one who's taken the huge reputational damage. Aside from that, what you're talking about here is something that he's done in his personal life, you know, and that's something that, you know, you cannot stand behind any of the things that go on. And you know, if the rumors are right, there could be some, may well be some more skeletons coming out of the cupboard. So, you know, why he behaved in this manner. And I just don't get that, because it's something that's, you know, first of all, he's on the wrong side of the legal side of all of those things. And in this world, you know, to behave in the way that he has done, although there's no criminal evidence yet to say that, the police are not investigating it anymore, but it's quite clear that he's been asked to leave the club. That has been confirmed, and obviously something went on there. So yeah, I mean, Phil, the brand of Phil and the brand of Tiger, you know, to you know, maybe not to the same extent, but certainly fall from grace for him as well too, with what's happened to him in the last few months too. So the two big stars of the game have certainly come a cropper in the last few years, as other players have benefited.
Yeah, I mean it's so interesting when you the way you bring Tiger up there, Paul. We don't have time to get into the detail now, but it could be argued that some of the things he has done over the last year it's even more egregious than anything that Phil has done. And yet Tiger, he doesn't quite get a free pass, but just doesn't seem to get the brand hammering maybe that Phil does. I mean, we went into it after his latest crash. Like, why is he on the road? And he's putting the lives of other people at risk every time he takes to the road instead of getting himself a driver. But we're not going to rake over those coals now. Listen, Paul, I'll be gripped to live from tonight again, as we are every week. Yourself and Brandon Chambly going out at there is brilliant TV. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us this week. Enjoy every minute of Shinnecock Hills. We'll hopefully catch up with you again soon. And look, let's hope maybe we might see Rory and Scotty going at it down the back nine at Shinnecock on Sunday evening. Gary, thanks so much for being with us. We are going to have the Ryan line coming your way later in the week, as we always do. And we have a watch along as well, the details of which will be on Discord. That's, we think, around 1 o'clock, 11 o'clock on Sunday morning. So that's another thing to look forward to as we kind of investigate the first three rounds and prepare to settle in for the evening to watch round four. Thank you, Gary. Thank you, Paul. Enjoy the weekend of golf. Enjoy the US Open. We'll chat to you next week. All my exes wear Rolexes, but I reside right here in Dardanelle, all picket town. Little JD starter kid right here.